Amen. You now may be seated. We're going to call on Brother Rodney once again to lead us in the next session. And hopefully you can see the video by now. All
right. Here's a video from the PBS group.
The election of Barack Obama caused many Americans to be proud of the country's movement toward racial integration and also to re-examine the difficulties involved in that, not least in churches, where 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is still the most segregated hour of the week. Lucky Severson has our special report.
If something seems odd or unusual about these worshipers, maybe it's the diversity, all the different colors and nationalities of their faces. This is the Willcrest Baptist Church in Houston. And Pastor Rodney Wu couldn't be more proud of the cultural and racial mix of his congregation.
I think my main passion is to get people ready for heaven. I think a lot of our people are going to go into culture shock when they get to heaven, and they get to sit next to somebody that they didn't maybe sit with while they were here on earth. So we're trying to get them acclimated a little bit.
Assuming Pastor Wu is right, there are a lot of congregations that need to get acclimated. A recent study found that only 7% of churches in the U.S. are integrated. This comes as no surprise to Ohio State sociology professor Corey Edwards, author of the book The Elusive Dream.
We're segregated in housing. Even the job market is segregated. We end up going to churches with people who look like us.
So sometimes, you know, you'll hear the statement of African Americans saying, I have to work with whites. I may have to shop with them, but on Sunday I don't want to have to worship with them. I want to be able to just be myself and let my hair down.
Rice University sociology professor Michael Emerson, who authored the study on the makeup of churches in the U.S., says racial separation inside most churches is even more pronounced than it is outside for a number of reasons.
What we found in the study is that the churches are 10 times less diverse than the neighborhoods they sit in.
Emerson also found that churches in the South were the least integrated, partly because African Americans are concerned about whites taking over their congregation.
That's a big fear, right? And when I talk with black pastors, the same thing. If we try to have this move towards interracial congregations, whites will just dominate then. There's so many more of them, and they're used to being in the position of power, so they'll just take over and we'll lose the one thing we do have.
And so what happens in these congregations where you have whites and blacks, even though they may be well-intended, people coming together, wanting to do the Christian thing, wanting to serve God together, you're going to find that these kinds of issues that occur outside of the church come into the church.
The top of the morning to everybody.
Pastor Rufus Smith of the City of Refuge Church in Houston is one of very few African Americans who leads an interracial church. Smith says when he took over the Evangelical Presbyterian congregation, it was mostly white, bored, and dwindling. He said he would only agree to be pastor if members promised to integrate.
To their credit, many of those core people decided, you know, come hell or high water, we're going to try this thing and give it our best shot, though it was an experiment. And here now, 12 years later, we think it's a grand experience.
Today, the church is about 45% white, 45% black, and the rest Hispanic and Asian. But Pastor Smith says the grand experience hasn't always been pleasant.
You're certainly up against the natural stereotypes. You're up against ignorance. You're up against some hard-heartedness and, you know, some outright evil with respect to some people.
Pastor Rodney Wu, half Chinese, grew up in a black neighborhood, went to an all-white church, and married his Hispanic childhood sweetheart.
Poor rich. Let me tell you who they are. They are the people who have a lot of money and nothing else.
When he came here, the church had only 2 black members out of 180. Today, Willcrest Baptist has 500 members divided almost equally among whites, blacks, and Hispanics, with the remainder made up of Asians. Wu says he didn't realize how difficult it was going to be integrating his church.
When we started, a lot of people were going, this is making me feel uncomfortable. Whether the kids were in the nursery together or their kids were in the youth group, a lot of parents were fearful that their kids might start dating somebody that was a different race.
in the beginning stages, there's often a lot of pain, a lot of confusion, a lot of people leave. Maybe there's even anger. But if they can make it through that, it becomes something that people just, a lot of times will say, I couldn't live without it.
Ask me how I feel. If I was any better, I would have to be twins. And that's the truth if I ever told it.
Pastor Rufus Smith has succeeded in not only integrating his church racially, his congregation comes from all walks of life. When it grew, he deliberately located the church between affluent and low-income neighborhoods. Carol Vance, a former district attorney, was one of the founding members.
We picked Rufus because he's a great pastor, not because he's black. But I think it's wonderful that he is, because we're sitting right here on the edge, and I sort of like to think of our church as the bridge over troubled waters.
To me, one of the true tests of the power of the gospel is to unify people across socioeconomic, racial lines, which is what the heart of Christianity is and was.
Karen Giesen has a doctorate degree in theology. She says she grew up in a white church where people bowed their head, folded their hands, and worshiped quietly. Very different from what she experiences at City of Refuge.
The worship style is an issue. None of us are right in probably our heart language style. I mean, we're all making a sacrifice to be there. It's a mix. A lot of people go looking for churches saying, I'm looking for the one that ministers to me. And to go here, we've obviously all made a choice that we want to serve there.
Rebecca Miller wants to be a pastor. She says she searched to find a church that felt like a community.
People worship the way the Spirit leads them to worship. I really don't think that there is anybody saying you can't shout, you can't scream, you can't say hallelujah, and you can't clap your hands. It's not the typical Presbyterian, you can't raise your head church.
Where we really changed, and we saw the growth grow exponentially, was when the church became less than 50% white, and so there was no majority group. And that just changed the entire mindset.
Church guitarist Jim Cruz married a Hispanic and adopted a Hispanic child. He says he's learning a few things about his own prejudice.
What we're learning is that you may not come to it thinking you're prejudiced. You may be seriously trying not to be prejudiced. But then you find out the things you're doing come across as prejudiced. So I think a lot of our effort has been to learn to relax, to let people be people.
It would be difficult to find a more graphic example of religion bridging a racial divide than Dwight Pryor and Rick Taylor. Taylor describes himself as a reformed redneck.
From where I come from, to be honest, I was taught to hate people like Dwight, and to not have anything to do with them, and that they were less than I was. And I believed that most of my life. I truly did. But the Lord has a way of showing you your prejudices in your life.
Mm-hmm. I grew up in North Mississippi. As a little kid on those school buses, watching those people shout racist names at me, and some of them were deacons and pastors in our community, it left a cold chill in my heart, a hatred.
Dwight is a control systems designer, and Rick is a retired general contractor. The bond that has grown between them is plain to see.
Racism colors the truth. It makes people not look at other people as if they were human. It goes that deep. Mm-hmm. It truly does.
It does.
And Christ teaches us that we're all the same.
Are churches that integrate richer because they did it?
Yeah, I never meet a church that wishes they didn't do it. I never meet a leader that wishes they didn't do it. They will all say to the person, it's hard, it's difficult, it comes with complexities and confusion.
And they will say, if they're like Dwight and Rick, that church integration may not always come easy, but it comes with rich rewards and improbable friendships. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Houston.
I just want to know, just real quickly, because you've seen the visual, Are there any, just what's your first response? And by the way, Pastor Rufus is a good friend of mine, and he's a lone, and I can repeat, a lone Presbyterian. Not many Presbyterians are doing what he's doing, and he feels very isolated by his denomination. There's obviously two types of Presbyterians and their mindset, some very evangelical and some are not, and he's part of the evangelical group, but yet even in that, he's very isolated. So just a word of encouragement from other denominations that are tackling the same thing that we are. But initial response, just reaction, anybody, vocally, verbally, out loud, here, now. What's that? Oh, hope. So I can talk about it, but unless you see it, it's just a different impact. Anybody else? Just initial response. And I'm going to ask for questions in just a minute, okay? But any others? Just a response, just from what you see. Oneness of thought. I'm going to repeat if y'all can't hear what they say. Yes, ma'am. Anxious. In what way? Okay. Very honest and transparent. Thank you. I've been anxious for 18 years. It's challenging. Once you taste it, like Dr. Emerson, he's a good friend of mine, Michael. By the way, the Rice professor was our deacon in our church for 5 years, and now he's a deacon in our church plant. That's a multiracial church plant who has an African-American church, has a pastor, African-American, who was our former minister to our students. So we're very connected. So he's been with our church plant, and he's also been with our main church. So it's been an interesting road for him as well. But once you like he says, once you go down this road, you'll never regret it. But it doesn't mean it's easy. Questions, just initial questions. And maybe the questions relate back to the biblical basis we talked about last session or something you've seen. And then we'll tackle some other issues. But I wanted to just kind of take an expression time here. Questions or observations?
But that was the truth of the gospel.
Yeah. It's truth of the gospel. So coming alive, you can see it, you live it. It's not that, when we'll talk about this at the end, whether or not is the goal colorblind. I don't think in the United States colorblind is a great goal, because what that means for a lot of races is that you ignore the pain in the past. And so it's like a gloss over. But I do think there's a celebration of color, that there's a richness in color. And so we're still working through that aspect. Any questions or observations? Yes, Pastor.
If there were, what was the great spirit?
Huh. If you wouldn't mind holding that question, because we're going to do risk and rewards, and then we'll do a section called Giants in the Land. And there's so many that I've only been able to capture about 8 of them, but I took the top 8. But great question. But and some of the questions that you might ask, we're going to deal with, but that one we'll deal with specifically. What is the greatest fears? What are the greatest obstacles? What are the greatest risk? Yes, Moses.
Ah.
Yes. Excellent. When does the church become multiracial? Is it in attendance, like the 80-20? Or is it in leadership? Or is it in worship? Or is it in vision? I know when we made the change, 180 whites gathered together, we adopted this vision statement. So I think one, obviously, is vision. But we had to make some tangible changes that were visible. And I scoured the country back in the early 90s for churches that looked like what I wanted to look like, and there were none. Or if they were, they were doing it intuitively and not intentionally, and it was just kind of like a byproduct about where they were and what they were doing. So, but nobody really in the early 90s were intentionally doing this. So it was tough. But I had to interview missionaries to gain a grasp on anything in this realm. And what we discovered is we had to change two areas that were visible, worship and leadership. Just kind of, that's what people see, who's in charge, and how do you express yourself? So we tackled those two items. So I think if you put the combination platter, as we do a lot in our Chinese food and our Mexican food, if you put the combination platter of vision at the core, and then worship and leadership as a two. And to me, the fuel for multiracial worship, for multiracial ministry is missions. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. So those are kind of like the two gauges. Your leaders, who's in charge, who make decisions, and what does the worship look like? Regardless of the demographic. Now, you have to have some demographic, obviously, but that's obviously not the ultimate gauge. Very good question. Yes? Absolutely. They're all over. Tragically, we'll give you the stats. The ones that are most successful, 12% of all multiracial churches who have pastors have mixed racial backgrounds. Like myself would be part Chinese, part white. And that seems to be one of the helpful things. Okay. The other ones are the fewest, and this is what's broken my heart, the fewest pastors of multiracial churches are in the African American led. And then there's quite a few in the Hispanic and Asian, but whites are the ones that are predominantly the pastors of multiracial churches. But sadly, the African Americans are the ones that are having the biggest challenge as far as pastoring. Good question though. Anybody else? Questions? Yes, sir. Hey, Dave. Very good. First generation, we might want to call them. First generation immigrants. Yeah. Right. The language has to be the key. We saw that in Pentecost, did we not? In Acts 2. And when they hear their language in their own tongue, remember they heard the word in their own tongue and they understood. So obviously that is huge in the gospel communication. And so in our church, the way we've dealt with it is initially we did it wrong. We went after first generation immigrants and just hit the wall, just every wall that you can imagine, just absolute failure. Then we started targeting through Awanas and through some other ministries, community ministries, in the schools, ESLs, tutoring, projects, drug intervention, Big Brothers, all of that. And we started hitting second generation. But what was remarkable is as a result of the second generation kids coming in, that all of a sudden, regardless of the language barrier, the parents and the grandparents started coming because we cared about their kids. Now we have simultaneous translation that I preach in English, historia predica in inglés, and my brothers would translate in Spanish through a transmitter. And there's a church in Beaverton, Oregon, unbelievable. They have 300 headsets that they translate into three languages at Village Baptist, Mandarin, Korean, and Spanish. It's like the UN. It's awesome. So it's a challenge. And Mark DeMise, who will come in September 25th, his church in Arkansas, Little Rock, Arkansas, 25, 30 different nations representing his church. They do simultaneous translation in everything. One screen will be English, one screen will be Spanish. So they're doing it constantly. Just different approaches, kind of depends on who you are and where you are and how that's expressed. Any other questions or comments? Yes, sir. Integrate it with more than 20%. At least 20% of a minority group or more. And 5% evangelicals. Like if you throw the Catholic aside and the Buddhist and all that, and you just put evangelicals, it actually lessens to only 5%. And most of these churches that are 5%, this is tragic, are in transition. Like if you come in 5 years later, they won't be that. They're in transitional neighborhood, so they're kind of going through the change. But 5 years later, like Emerson, my friend, set up an interview with a Filipino, 50% Filipino, 50% African American. He set up the interviews. They flew 20 interviewers out from Rice to do all the research, and they planned it 6 months in advance. They arrived on the scene, got to the church, 100% Filipino. 6%, 6 months before, they were half and half. They said, "What happened? No one told us." It was awesome. And they said, well, they got their feelings hurt, and they left. So even when we look at 20%, I mean, 5%, even those churches aren't really an accurate depiction of really multiracial churches. They're just going through the change, and 5 years later, they're not going to be that. They just live in a transitional neighborhood, and it's moving in that direction. So I would say it's even less, which is sad. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, in the back. Yeah. The question comes back, is it a region issue like Houston versus North Carolina or whatever? And I would say no. And I used to say yes. I thought it was more of an urban possibility. Like if you lived in an urban environment, it would be much more likely or much less challenging. But what we've discovered in the last 15 years is that America is going to be non-majority by the year. It was 2056. They readjusted the numbers, and it's 2048 or 2047 is the most recent stats, which means our country will be no majority group. And what that means is even in the rural areas, a lot of with the Hispanic population, I was in Yakima. Any of y'all know where Yakima, Washington is? I mean, it's like a town of 50,000. And 50% of the population is Hispanic. So you're talking about in the middle of the state of Washington, you have 50%, and there's maybe one Hispanic church, and there's I met with a group of about 15 churches, or a coalition of churches that were all white and dying. So if it can happen in Yakima, I was in Arkadelphia, Arkansas, which is the place for Arkansas Baptist University, Washita Baptist, population of 10,000. We did a conference on this where half the churches were black, half the churches were white, and the Hispanics were moving in. So we're talking about a town of 10,000 in the middle of Arkansas dealing with this issue. So it's not just an urban issue or possibility. I think it's all across. So I think it extends beyond regionality. Second to your question is, I think the walls are not only in the whites, I think the walls in every ethnic group. In fact, I know they are. So, and every group wants their own expression. Every group wants their own comfort zone. Every group wants their own worship. Every group wants their own food. Every group wants their own organization. And so we've hit walls in every group. So it's been a tough, tough sell. In fact, just honestly, as we go through, as many nations as we had, our last wall that we had to cross at Willcrest was the African Americans. We had a lot of Africans, we had a lot of Caribbeans, we had a lot of mixed marriages that were interracial marriages, but we were not getting African American families until we went non-majority group in 2002. In the last 3 years, we've had more African Americans join our church than any other group combined. So what year was that? Year 15. In a very intentional walk. So I'm just saying the battle is not short. It is a very long journey. And we've been very intentional, very hyper-intentional, and we've been doing everything we could. And yet that has been the last barrier in Houston to reach in our church. So that's been a very big struggle. I tell you what, do you have the PowerPoint? No? Is that possible? I'm going to pull up the risk and the rewards. If you go to chapter 6, let's go to chapter 6. And this is a survey that I took in our own church in the year 2007. And I just asked the church, you can go ahead and hit one more. Keep going. All right, here it is. These are the rewards that our people listed. I asked them not to sign their names. I asked a very detailed survey because I wanted absolute, total, honest truth about what were the primary rewards of being a part of a multiracial church. This comes from a group of people that have been doing it for 15 years. So they're not like novices. And they come from a vast array of racial and ethnic backgrounds. So number one is celebration of diversity. That's the number one. I mean, that's the top vote getter as far as, and I left it blank. I didn't give them a choice to choose from. I just asked them to write, list as many rewards as they could think of, and that was by far the top one. Let me give you a couple quotations. A white man said, seeing the diversity of the people in the kingdom of God is a constant reminder of how big our God's kingdom is. And an Indonesian woman says, it seems like a picture with a lot of color in it. A black woman says, I feel that this is a peak of what heaven's going to be like, every race, every creed, and color together. Hispanic woman said, I see splashes of color all throughout the sanctuary. It's a glorious sight. This is just a lot of input about diversity and celebration of diversity. Number two, and this is really was a surprise to me, that because they're in a multiracial or multiethnic environment, that they feel a strong sense of acceptance. A white woman says, I'm loved for who I am and not what I look like. A Cuban member says, it's okay to worship God and not have to change or hide my ethnicity. A black woman says, we notice a change in Willcrest. Now there are so many blacks here, I don't even know them all. I don't even know all the Hispanics. My husband says, now we are welcome. This place is for us. Strong sense of acceptance. Number three, and this is my passion, is develop of a global Christian perspective. And so this is the part that they get to see the world through God's lenses. Willcrest has been the shift in focus from community to global, is what one of our members said. A Korean who took a survey, who's very closely connected to one of our members but not a member, said this: the global Christian perspective pushes each member out of their racial and ethnic and cultural zone and challenges them to see those around them through a different set of lenses. And we interviewed one white guy that says he learned from the West African culture is that it's a different perspective of how family is seen. And I know in the white culture, any of y'all, when I mention the word in-laws, what do you think? You jump up in joy, right? In-laws, you know, it's like my favorite thing. But this is what he says: I learned from our African culture that there's no concept of in-law. Either a person is part of the family or they are not. What a remarkable insight, right? So now everybody's family. The other one is navigating the American socioeconomic educational system. A lot of first-generation immigrants, their networks is totally different. Jobs, schools, shopping, medical, doctors, all that kind of stuff. The last one is passing on the multiracial vision to the next generation. That's very big. We've had an influx of young couples come to our church, and they travel 40 miles. In Houston, they pass thousands of churches to come to our church. Because there's 3,500 churches, evangelical churches in Houston, and you travel 40 miles across Houston, you're passing quite a few. But their passion is to raise their kid with this perspective. And so we have a lot of that. Now, flip side, rewards. And now we risk. This doesn't sound any familiar. I know this is only Houston reward. I mean, risk. I know North Carolina is spiritual, much more spiritual than Houston. So y'all are not going to be able to relate to any of these. Here's number one. And number one risk: relinquish control of leadership and ability to make decisions. Let me quote some of our white members, all right? I thought there was a bias against whites at Willcrest in pursuit of having multiracial leadership. But he confessed, the kingdom of God is bigger than my personal ambitions. We have to be ready to forfeit our rights and desires for the sake of the body of Christ. Emerson states in this area, he says, numerical minority group members have the highest relational cost. So regardless of what the whites think they have to give up, the people who have to, or the majority group, whether it's whites or blacks, is the minority are the ones who have to pay the highest price to come in. Sometimes we forget that. We think, well, we have to give up our control. We have to give up our deacons. We have to give up our worship. We have to give up our committees. We have to give up our parking spots, whatever. So the next one is worship. Can you imagine? One black lady says, Pastor, don't take this wrong, but I listen to my gospel music on the way to church because I don't get enough of it here. So she's definitely sacrificing. If any of y'all don't know what I'm talking about, we'll explain it later. But it's just worship. You have to sacrifice. We have our worship leader. If you go to our website, there's a CD that's available that you can tap into. We just are publishing another CD that if you close your eyes, you think you're in Cuba, or you think you're in Africa, or you think you're in the Deep South with gospel, you think that you're in the Caribbean, or it's just a different sound. And in fact, our musicians, and y'all would be challenged, this might be right up y'all's alley, musicians, but they can take one hymn that we just sang and do it in eight different styles. So you'll think that you're in like, it's like a salsa sound, and then it has a Caribbean sound, then it has an African sound, but it's the same hymn. I know that some of you may be familiar with this, but some of us clap on 1/3 beat, some claps on 2/4 beat. Okay, and it's just a little confusing in our church sometimes. So, but worship styles, all right? We have a statement around our church that says in Philippians 4:5 that says, "Let your forbearing spirit be made known to all men." One of the definitions of forbearance from one of the commentators says this: giving people permission to be different. So you come into our worship style, or you come into our worship, and you have a variety of styles. We have a lady in our choir. Her name is Hazel. She's from Jamaica. We call it the Jamaican shuffle. She does things that nobody else does. Her gyrations are a little different. She's 82 years old, and the way her body moves is a little bit different to choreograph and to pocket. I mean, we can't manufacture that. That's just her expression. Then we have our Africans are very expressive. Our Latinos are very expressive. We have whites that are, some are expressive, but some are not. We have one white in our choir that just does this, and he never moves. And my boy says, "I think he's saying the field goal is good." But he just never moves. And so, but people are sitting, people are standing, people are clapping, people are raising their hands. And yet you see maybe 20, 30, 40 different expressions of worship in the same song. Permission to be different. But it's a risk. The next one is family. This is a little tough one. A lot of people have lost a lot of contact with family because of coming to our church. Whether it's relations, whether it's marriage, whether it's the worship, but family says, "Why are you going there? You're diluting your culture. You're watering it down. You're offensive. Why are you worshiping with those people?" Family. Another one is leaving their comfort zone. Everybody has a comfort zone. Last one is prejudices toward other races. Have you noticed, amazing, and these are all what our members wrote down. Have you noticed that all of them have some connection with what we call sin? Just an observation. All right. Any questions on these risks or rewards? There were a lot more, by the way, but those are the ones that hit the top on the top numbers. But all right, now we're going to go to the next chapter, Giants in the Land, real quickly. What kind of, when we made the shift, what were some of the things that we had to face? And I use the analogy, and by the way, every chapter kind of has a biblical, I call it bifocal lenses. Every chapter in the book has a biblical kind of foundation or direction, and then we tell the biblical part, principle, and then we give the Wilcrest story. So it's kind of an in-depth study of one church, but through biblical lenses, where it has admonished us, corrected us, challenged us, and changed us. And they're giants in the land. And most of you are familiar when there's a 12 spies were sent to check out the land, the promised land. And as they did, we call it a 10 spy report and a 2 spy report. Anybody remember what the 10 spy report said? We call it the majority report. Yeah. Oh, there's great things in the land. Milk, honey, right? Clusters of grapes. But there are what? Giants in the lands. And not only were there giants in the lands, when we saw the giants, we became what? Grasshoppers. That's called perception, isn't it? But then there's a minority report, a 2 spy report, and what did they say? We can do it. Now, any of y'all have ever heard in a Baptist church majority? Okay. Are minorities as far as voting? Okay. I'm just saying that sometimes the majority report is not always accurate, nor is it always from God. Okay. Sometimes. I'm not saying every time. Just sometimes. All right. So let's see some of the obstacles that we... if you can click through some of these. One more. Keep going. Back up. Sorry. Obstacles from within. We had... As soon as we adopted the vision to be a multiracial church, what do you think happens? Our attendance increased? Decrease. I'm making a good sales pitch for those who are... tempted to follow God's call on this one. If you go multiracial, you will lose people. I'm not lying. I want to paint a picture that's real. I'm not going to paint you a picture that's going to be as soft and easy. But I think we had a master by the name of Jesus Christ that says, if anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself, take up your cross, and follow me. How many followers did we get? When he says, if you're going to be a part of me, you must eat my blood and drink my blood and eat my flesh. As a result of this in John 6, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him. And he turned to his 12 and he says, are you going to go away also? Then in Matthew 7, he says, oh yeah, by the way, enter by the narrow gate. How many people are there? Few. So just understand that the call of God doesn't always mean increase of attendance. All right, decrease. Now, for the last 45 years, African Americans have made 62% of what the average white Americans make. So I'm coming from a white perspective church making the transition. So when we became a multiracial church and we had the same number of people, but yet not all of them are white, what do you think happened to the giving? Oh, this is a great sell to our pastors. You have less people and less money. Are you ready? But that's exactly what happened. Our giving decreased. There's also initial passive resistance within, when even though people would say, hey, they can come, but when they came, they weren't included. They weren't, we had demographically a very diverse church, but we had an all-white choir, all-white leaders, white style of worship, white greeters, white Sunday school teachers. It was an initial passive resistance within. So even though they were coming, we weren't making the proper adjustments. So these are the giants. Next one. Go ahead. The other one was we had fluctuating staff. If you think it's a hard sell for people and the lay people, it's a hard sell for staff to get leaders who will commit to doing this, because it just gets tired. And so we had fluctuating staff constantly. We had a short, in fact, our worship leader left for a year and then came back. But the reason he left was he just got tired. His kids were growing up. They were in elementary school. They lived in a tough neighborhood. He was from South Louisiana, and he went to Alabama to a larger church, more money, all white, everything. 9 months later, he calls and says, can I come home? But you just have fluctuating staff. Shortage of lay leadership. Let's do the math. If people join your church, all right, when they join, they come from other churches, right? And if 95% of the other churches are all one color and they come to a multiracial church, that's challenging. In fact, we rarely got people from other churches because it made people so uncomfortable. So we had to actually grow this way, winning people to Christ. It's a novel approach to church growth. But what happens is, for years, we had 5-to-1 ratio, 6-to-1 ratio between the number of baptisms versus the number of people that would transfer, because you just didn't get people coming in who are accustomed to certain styles, leadership, organizational structures. So what happens is, if you have adult conversions, how long does it take for them to become leaders? A long time. In fact, our first commander, our second commander in Awanas, was he was a recovering drug addict and alcoholic. And for 8 years, he was dry. And so for 3 years, he was our commander in our Awanas. We had 100 kids in our Awanas programs. Everything was moving. And then he fell back into drugs. But that's pretty common in our experience to have adults that have so much baggage, because they get saved when they're 30 or 40 or 50. And you live life without Christ after 30 or 40 years, and your life isn't really moral. So it takes a long time to develop leaders. In fact, our first deacon that we ordained was 8 years after we started. No, 10 years after we started the process, because nobody was qualified according to biblical qualifications in our church that we grew up. It just took a long time to develop leaders. Next one. The giant of the temporary. My wife calls us, this is our favorite, stop and go church. We have people coming through all the time. In fact, the first couple years we had to gain 100 people to stay the same every year. So we started with 200. First year, we baptized 75 people. Second year, we baptized 75 people. After the end of 2 years, guess how many we were running? 200 people. And yet people are constantly moving, constantly going through. A lot of times in multiracial churches, you get a lot of transitional people for whatever reason. A lot of them coming from immigrants, different countries, work visas, students, people that are just in motion. And so it's a very tough go there. Next one. The giant of spiritual fatigue. How many pastors are here on staff? Raise your hand, or ministry. Anybody know what 24/7 means? It means that your pastor 24/7. It's constant, right? Now, you had the complexity, the challenges of being a pastor or a leader, and then you add the multiracial factor. We have conflict every week. People misunderstand. People didn't get the right music. People were offended. People were miscommunicated. It didn't include this. Every single week, after 18 years, there's still conflict. You get tired. Spiritual fatigue. Next one. So we call facing the giants. And we use the same David model where he calls the most unlikely people but uniquely gifted. And when he released all the armor that Saul provided, that God will release all the human things and just give you everything you're equipped and need to be equipped. And the last one is it will announce the glory of God. We had a Baptist General Convention of Texas film crew came and did a story on us, and they're all in their 50s. They're all white, and they all come from North Dallas. Now, you may not know Dallas geography, but that's where all the whites live, in North Dallas. And so they came to our church with a film crew, and as we were in a worship service, and they were filming it for their piece, and I was sitting right where our organist is sitting, and he comes up behind me, and this guy is just, the producer is just crying his eyes out, and was in the middle of the worship, said, "Hey, are you all right?" He says, "Oh, I've never seen anything like this. This is like the most moving scene. This is like heaven. You do not have to preach." And I went, "No, I have to preach. You're the one with the issues. I'm good." So after the service, he interviewed us, and he was just talking through it. And this is what he said. He said, "You know, when I heard you were a multiracial church and we were coming to do a piece on you, I thought the African-Americans would sit here, the whites would sit here, the Asians would sit here, the Hispanics over here, and y'all would be in different groups. But you guys actually sit together. They act like they know each other. And you know what? They look like they love each other because they are up hugging each other." And he was just amazed. But it shows the greatness. We have people come in. We had 25 Methodist D-Men students come and do a site visit in January of our church. And they just sat there. They were in the middle section. And they were just crying their eyes out. Because it shows the greatness of God. I'm telling you, when the world sees what God does through this, there's no other explanation. All right? Now we're going to fast forward. Let me deal with worship a little bit. So we're all the way to chapter 10. I know that's a long way, so just keep clicking. Any of y'all think that might be an issue? Worship? If you don't know it's an issue, let me tell you, it's an issue. People get a little, I wouldn't say violent, but I would say volatile when it comes to worship. So we kind of had to retrain our people on what worship is. Worship is, who's the audience? God. That changes the rules in worship, doesn't it? You're not the audience. It's not a show. It's not a performance. It is, God is the audience. We are worshiping. He's the one that's looking. We're the participants. So we use Isaiah 6 model, which is, "I saw the Lord, high and lifted up," and talked about the sin and the confession and woe is me. We used John 4:24, "God is spirit and we must worship him in spirit and truth," not in culture and tradition. A little different. And then, let's go on, one more. These are the aspects what we've had to be challenged. Music, we had to make some adjustments in music. Our worship leader is very eclectic. He's Cajun, or Hispanics would like to say he's Cajun. Okay, so he's grown up with the blues, jazz, country, gospel, anthems, praise and worship, hymns. So God's uniquely gifted him. But even times he can't lead, he steps back and our people step forward. whether it's our Africans and our Caribbeans or our Hispanics, they step up and they lead the worship. He says one of the most challenging things is getting the right instrumentalists to do this worship. Because if you're in an African-American organist versus an Anglo organist, it may be a little different. Keyboardists, different. Drummers, different. It's just different sounds, different beats, different rhythms. So music is very challenging. Pastors, let me help you on this one. Preaching is a little different in a multiracial church. As I said earlier, we're very dialogical now. I talk and I engage the people because a lot of our African Americans come in and they're talking to me anyway, right, in the middle of the service. So why not engage that and encourage that and become participatory? I talked to you about the use of greeters. The time factor. In an Anglo worship, the average time limit for an Anglo worship is 70 minutes, okay? 70 minutos, okay? 70 minutes. The average African-American church, which some of you might find hard to believe, is only 105 minutes, okay? Multiracial church is right in between at 83. So what happens is everybody's making sacrifices in a worship service. The whites, we're going to have to let go of the time. All right? The African-Americans, you're just going to have to kind of swallow and ask for a double dose, like come to the second service, you know, do something. All right? So it's just going to be a shift. Time is very important in our culture, is it not? And so that's part of the things that we've had to, we have Asian time, we have Latino time, we have all this time. But you know what? It's not only time, it's perception of time. Where a lot of our people think that if you're not on time, you're disrespectful. Where other people would come in, if you show up early, you think you're so important that the meeting can't start without you. So as one of our members said, you know what? If you show up early, you show up late, you're still in trouble. So we got to work through time, all right? Expressive worship and quiet behavior, we talked about that. Use of different languages, we talked about that. Let's go through the next one. There's three models of multiracial service, what we call an assimilation model. And then another model is using music that is new to all cultures. And the last one is culturally conscious worship model. Let's back up a little bit. Stay on those three. Back up. Okay, assimilation model says, even though we're demographically diverse, we're all going to worship one way. Whether it's all black or all white or all Hispanic or all Korean or all Vietnamese, it doesn't matter. We're going to all worship the same way. It's not bad or good. These are just models. We're not putting a judgment on it. We're just saying these are models. All right. Second one is a lot of churches like Mosaics in L.A. with Erwin McManus, they create their own music. Brooklyn Tab. Y'all familiar with Brooklyn Tab? They create a lot of their music. They write their own music. So they kind of develop their own sound. They have musicians in their thing that develop their own expression of worship. And the last one is what we tried to do, is try to be culturally conscious and try to incorporate. So when people come into our choir or our music group and they have a different sound or different beat or different expression of worship, we let them write their own stuff, but we also let them be a part of many who do that. Okay? Next one. Sometimes you need divine intervention in worship. I am not lying to you. Okay, some of you are already freaking out. In fact, my publisher freaked out with that little word being slain in the spirit. And by the way, Broadman is a Southern Baptist publisher. He said, "You really want to use that phrase?" And I went, "Well, it's kind of a part of our what God's done to us." So let me walk you through vision of Hasan Khan. In this vision, we had a guy that was visiting our church from India, and he was a Muslim. And he was dating a girl that was a Pentecostal. All right. So this Indian who was a Muslim was very dark complected. He was very small. And they would only come on Wednesday nights in the prayer meeting. All right. And the girl was really white, like no makeup white, like dresses only white, like Pentecostal. Any of y'all know what Pentecostals are? Okay. So you got a very white, bright girl and a very dark complected Pentecostal. Then you have and they're dating. And I said, "Why are y'all here?" And they said, "Well, we go to her church on Sunday, then we go to the mosque, and we just had to find something in the middle of the week in between Pentecostals and Muslims." I went, "We're not in between, y'all." It's like I'm looking, but we become good friends. We ate with Hassan. My boys befriended him. We hung out with him, shared the gospel. He shared the Islamic belief. So we went through that whole process. But on one particular day, our youth group was in Jackson, Mississippi, doing a multiracial youth ministry choir tour. And we just felt compelled to pray. So there were about 60 or 70 of us in the auditorium in prayer meeting. And we fell on our faces and we prayed. And he was there. At the end of the service, I'm walking out. And he's crying. He says, "Pastor, can I talk to you?" I said, "What's the matter, son?" He said, "No, I want to talk to you." So I pulled him in the office. And he said, "Pastor, while you were praying, I had a vision." I went, "We don't do visions. We're Baptist." And he just looked at me and he said, "No, really, I had a vision, Pastor." I went, "Oh, okay." Now I'm curious, right? So I said, "What'd you see?" He said, "While you were praying, right behind you, there were four crosses." Now he's got my attention, right? And he says, "The Holy Spirit came down from the cross and gave me a hug." What do you think that means? And I'm going, "Hey, dude, I just told you I don't do visions. So if we don't do visions, how are we interpreting visions, right?" But I prayed. I said, "God, you gave visions to interpretation to Joseph, to Daniel. Please, Lord, give it to me just one time." And this, by the way, is the only time it's ever happened. Don't ask me to interpret anymore. This is it. I did it one time. And this is what came out of my mouth. "How many crosses were outside of Jerusalem?" And he went, "Three." "Okay." I said, "That last cross, that fourth cross, was yours." And when the Holy Spirit came down from the cross, it means that God wants a personal, intimate relationship with you. And he just started crying. He says, "I'm ready to receive Christ." First Muslim convert in our congregation. See, we could do multiracial all we want to, but we can't manufacture that. So I'm just telling you that there may be some unusual things that, okay, if you hear stories from the mission field, when the gospel breaks through, like in India, when they would do prayer walks back in the 80s and 90s, and people would come in, and the people in the village had never heard the gospel, but they had visions of Jesus Christ. The Turkish guy that I baptized my last Sunday there, and his wife from Iran, she comes over. And she says, "Pastor," and we walked through a translator. I had to get a translator to walk through Farsi. And come to find out, while she was in Turkey delivering her baby, she had a vision of Christ. I'm going, "It's probably the medication, I don't know." But she says, "While I saw Christ," and she was part of the Muslim and all of that stuff. And she said, "Right when I saw Christ, I asked him to come into my life." So there's just unusual things that take place when you cross racial barriers and ethnic barriers. I wish we had time to talk about leadership, because leadership is key. But let me just give you one input, and then we'll have a few times for questions, and we'll take a break, or we'll go to lunch. But in our leadership, we actually ask people what we call H3O. I want you to have three H's. If you're going to be a multiracial leader, you have to have three H's. The first one is history. The second one is head, and I'll talk to you what that means. And the third one is heart. All right? History is this. You cannot lead people further than where you've been. You cannot say, "We're going to be a multiracial church," and you have like zero friends, zero contacts, zero networks with anybody outside of your race. Now, some of you are saying, "Okay, I got that." But some of you think, "I'm going to need to be an expert on multiracial churches." And I'm saying, no, the key is just to be one step ahead of the people. Y'all, and y'all remember parenting? Y'all do remember that, right? How many of you knew everything as a parent? That was before we had kids, right? Then we have kids and we learn as we go, right? But see, the secret of conveying to our children is that we know more than you, but we only had to know a little bit more than they know, right? To kind of move along. And that's the way it is with being a leader. You have to have some history to lead people, but you don't have to be an expert. So some of you are going to need to get out of your bubble and get across lines, whether in friendships and networks and churches and ministry or whatever it is. Sometimes it's taking a mission trip, whatever it is, getting outside to have some exposure, history. Second is head. It's just principles. I was in Singapore. They were giving me like 100 rules of what to do or not to do in the Asian environment. I've been in the Latin American countries a lot. I've been to African countries a lot, but not in the Asian countries. And I was sitting in a hotel area, and I had my feet up. And the lady came very nicely and picked, she picked my feet up and put them on the ground. I went, I don't think I was supposed to do that, because that was the principle. You go into Mexico and you're wearing jeans in a worship service, you're like a heathen. See, you have to know the rules. So that every culture has rules. I have a guy by the name of Getachew in our church, and he's from Ethiopia. And so when I come up to him, he bows and calls me Abba. He's 78 years old, and he's called me Abba. Makes me nervous. I mean, really? I mean, And so I bow, and he bows lower, and then I bow, and pretty soon we're talking to each other on the ground. But we have to know the rules. But while he's bowing to me, we have the Latinos that are coming up and hugging me. And in fact, if you don't hug them, they're deeply offended and they'll leave the church. So you got to know the rules. All right? There's just certain ways to greet. There's certain ways to address. But you have to know the rules. So that's head. And by the way, it's constant learning. Don't ever think you'll know everything. It's just more and more and more and more and more. And the last one is heart. And this is, you just have to have a call and a passion. If you don't have heart, there's too many obstacles, too much resistance, too many things that go against you, not only in society, but even in denominations, and even in church traditions, and even in churches and individuals, that will cause resistance. And if you don't have a heart for it, if you don't like Paul says, woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. Even if he gets stoned, he's still preaching, because he has a heart for it. Even though he had to confront Peter with his table fellowship when he pulled out of eating with Gentiles in Galatians chapter 2, and Paul stood up to his face and says, you are not right. Why? Because he has a heart for it. All right, it is 12:10. So we have I know we're going to go to a time of eating, but are there any questions? I wish we had a lot more time to cover a lot of this, but I just wanted to at least cover this. And maybe the last thing I had to say, can this happen anywhere? And I would dare say that God's kingdom always starts small. He takes a little seed, and it grows into a mustard seed. It's one of the smallest seeds, and it grows into a plant. God's kingdom always starts with a little bit of leaven, and it leavens the whole lump. And even though it may be a long journey, God doesn't need much to do His work. And you may be the only one that walks out of here with a burning passion and an exposure of a call of God. And I'm telling you, I didn't get a lot of support in Houston from a lot of peers, from pastors, from churches. But when God puts something inside of you, it's irrevocable. So do not lose heart. Do not grow weary. In due time, God will reap, and you will reap what you've sown. Questions or comments or observations before we go into the next? We have about 5 minutes. Yes, ma'am. Yes, my wife calls it that. I'm going to give her credit.
What do you do to go after members that slip away?
Yeah. I failed to mention this, but we've placed, in the 18 years I've been there, we've probably placed 90 people under church discipline. So it depends on how they slip away. Can I come in? Yeah. Our retention rate is a lot better now. We've made some major changes in the area of discipleship, in the area of new members class, in the area of making sure people are connected. And we have a dinner eight group that people sign up for, that we put them in, where they eat in each other's homes once a month. And we put them in diverse eights. And that way they eat their own food. So we're trying to put connection. We have probably 10 to 15 different ways that people connect. Even our new believers, we put them in Awanas to just listen to the three-year-olds quote scripture verses. So we're constantly pulling them into service. We're constantly checking on them. We assign them deacons or Sunday school teachers or somebody, a connector of some sort. So our retention rate has gotten a lot better. Yeah, we had to close the back door on that. Anybody else? Questions or yes?
You mentioned about your friend, Pastor Rupert.
Yes.
And he feels isolated and all that. Why don't you share your vision with a lot of different states?
Yes. In fact, I'm telling you, North Carolina is rare. because we're here a second time dealing with this issue and then asking Mark DeMise to come. I think it's a very uncommon expression. A lot of times people are interested in it with President Obama election, and it's kind of raised some racial issues. So people are kind of catching, then we have the immigration issue. And so we have all these issues that come up, not totally based on race, but it has a lot to do with it. Then we have unemployment, then we have job issues, and we have now the school issues. So we have a lot of things that are coming across. That race isn't the center of all of it, but it's definitely a part of it, and a lot of times a primary part of it. So we're seeing a lot of people interested. I get calls maybe 3 or 4 times a week, all over the United States, calling the church, can you help? But as far as follow through, not many. Yet. Any other questions or one more? We have time for one more. It doesn't mean we'll take one more. Yes, Russ. Yeah, like a lot of our people would say, Pastor, besides you, the fact that you can't sing, because I can't, they say you can't sing black either. So if somebody tries to sing something they're not, it's actually not authentic. It's not real. So what we've tried to do is enlist, encourage connections and networks within the body to make some recruiting. So the music has been the hardest to recruit. Talented musicians, talented, gifted vocalists, because you don't want to do anything sloppy. You want to do excellence. But at the same time, it is very challenging. So that's been the slowest part, to incorporate different aspects of worship across racial and cultural lines. And his question is, don't you have to have some people in your church who can do that? And so this will be where maybe partnerships in the North Carolina or maybe in the Greensboro area where maybe you can borrow musicians or trade for 6 months, a year, just to at least introduce a certain style of music. We send our musicians, our choir does a lot of tours where we introduce certain styles of music that where people, exposure. And right now in North Carolina, I would say exposure is the primary thing. Just expose people to what God can do. Now I hand it over to Russ or okay, Ken. Thank you very much for allowing me to be a part of North Carolina.
Wow, here's a man who speaks from his heart and from his practice, but also being so transparent about the challenges being faced as far as working with different cultures. So thank you so much. We know God has given you the ability to be able to share your experiences. We want to say thank you. We want to do something here that would allow us, before we go to our closing part. You know, you've heard the messages right now. You've heard the challenge. Well, one of the things I think I really picked up from him, that this is a God thing that only God can do. It's something that you cannot contrive. It's something you cannot manipulate. It's something that only God can change in the hearts of people. And it needs to start with us. Maybe some of you right now are disturbed. Maybe some of you are confused. Some of you are just wrestling with this. Maybe some of you, you're resonating with this. But maybe the person next to you is somebody you need to just kind of pray with. So I'm just going to ask you to do something. Just write right around your chair there with 2 or 3 people within that group there. Just pray that God is going to do this movement in such a way we'll have a taste of heaven, and that there's going to be some changes that's taking place not only in our hearts but in our churches. But it needs to start as God's people pray. Let's also pray for Brother Rodney, that God will continue to use him and God will raise up more leaders like him, that God would make himself known in great ways. So just turn to the person next to you. And afterwards, I'm going to ask one of our directors of mission here, Larry Doyle, if that's okay. After just a few minutes of prayer, as we pray together as God's people, the person next to you, I'm going to ask him to pray that God is going to do something about what we've heard, that it would really be put into practice and God would be gloriously honored. So just turn to the person next to you, just 2 or 3. And whatever God has laid upon your heart to pray, just praying for one another, maybe for your church, for your own heart, for the nation, God is going to honor this. So just take time to pray with somebody. Maybe somebody you haven't prayed before. Somebody from another culture. Do this as well, would you? Thank you.